Hello, and welcome back to Book Therapy. This is Rob Cohen. I've noticed lately on the Book Therapy Twitter, Book Therapy 13, that there have been a flurry of new followers lately. I don't know who they are. I don't know how they find me. It could just be people who are trying to bolster their own numbers by following me so that I'll follow them back. And yeah, in most circumstances, I am following them back. Or maybe there are people who are actually listening to this or have some interest in it. So if that's the case, then please tweet me, write to me, direct message me, do whatever to get my attention so that I know you're out there, because I am interested to see if anybody's listening other than myself and a couple of other people who are close family members or people who I pay to listen. I think on iTunes, if you listen and you want to rate it, you can rate it. That might get more exposure. And who knows, maybe somebody else might listen to it just because you rated it. But anyways, feel free to tweet me at booktherapy13. I wanted to give you a heads up as to what we're going to be covering, I think, on the next time. I got Phil, my brother, to agree to another episode with me. I chose the book this time because he chose the last one. And so I chose a techno thriller, I guess that's what I'm going to call it. A submarine book, kind of a hearkening back to the good old days of the mid-1980s and 1990s and the Cold War and submarines and aircraft carrier books and things like that. So we're going to talk about the book called The Trident Deception by Rick Campbell. We're going to talk about that next time. But since it's been, I don't know, a good month or so since we last talked, I figured this would be a good episode just to give you an update on what I've been doing, what I've been reading. I took a look right before I signed on here and was very surprised to see that since Galveston by Nick Pizzolatto, the last book that we talked about, I've read five books, two, three, four, five. One of them, The Trident Deception, we'll talk about another time, so I'm not going to talk about it this time. But the other four, I did want to at least talk about for a couple minutes each. I don't want to get into too much detail, and I don't want to go on and on about them, frankly, because I don't remember them very well anymore. And so I guess that's an indication of whether the book was particularly good or whether it resonated with me, is how well I'm able to recollect after a few weeks what happened and the major plot points. So anyways, I wanted to start with a book that I talked about at the end of the last podcast called A Murder in Auschwitz by J.C. Stevenson. And I don't know if I would call it a novel so much as a long novella. I think it was only 250 pages, I guess. So I guess a book at that point. And it was a very interesting premise, and one that when I saw it on Amazon or Goodreads, wherever it was that it was recommended, it really grabbed my attention. It was something that I wanted to read. And it involves the story of an inmate, a prisoner, a concentration camp prisoner at Auschwitz, who happened to have been a very successful criminal defense attorney in Berlin prior to World War II. And there is a murder in Auschwitz, and one of the and so this gentleman is called upon to defend the defendant in some sort of a tribunal or trial in Auschwitz. And so it was an interesting premise, this idea that a Jewish prisoner in a concentration camp would resume his duties as a criminal defense attorney and take up the defense of somebody who happened to be one of the Nazi guards there at the camp. And the story was told basically two different time periods. It was told from the time period of starting with the main character and his family arriving at Auschwitz, and then also it was told in flashbacks of the story of his rise, his beginning as a criminal defense attorney, his rise up through the ranks of to becoming one of the better criminal defense attorneys in Berlin prior to the start of the war, and how he ended up defending the Nazi guard in Auschwitz. And so it was told in alternating chapters. One chapter would be in Auschwitz, and then the next chapter would be a flashback, and then vice versa. And I thought it was an interesting choice by the author to tell the story with the alternating chapters like that. And I felt that it kind of did me as a reader a little bit of a disservice. In a story like this, where the main character is in Auschwitz, I mean, you're pretty sure from the beginning that it's not going to have a happy ending. And so as you're reading the book, you're actually trying to figure out what the happy ending is going to be, or what the catharsis will be, because you know that the chances of our main character surviving Auschwitz and surviving the war are very, very slim, are his chances. And so it did a little bit detract from the story. It was kind of this looming, ominous, presence of no matter what the outcome of this trial and the defense of the Nazi guard, we know that it's not going to have a happy ending. So at least the hope is that it has some sort of an ending which is satisfying or uplifting. And so I don't want to give away how the story ended. But what I do want to mention about the ending is there it's an expectation that there's going to be an emotional reaction to the ending. And the emotional reaction that I had to the ending of the book was more a factor of my knowledge of the Holocaust and my knowledge of what the prisoners went through and how so many of them perished. It wasn't so much because of what happened to this main character. And I think that the reason why I didn't have such an emotional reaction to this main character specifically is because of the method by which the story was told, the alternating chapters. I think that if the story had been more of a linear fashion, starting in, I think it was the 1920s, when our hero, our main character, is starting off as an attorney and learning the ropes as basically an apprentice or a junior associate, and then working his way up through various trials, and then he ends up defending this gentleman for murder, and he gets the guy acquitted, and it turns out that this is the same guy who is the Nazi guard who, again, is put on trial for murdering another Nazi. I think that if it had been told in a straight linear fashion, I would have developed more of an attachment to the character, not just him, but his wife, and he had two daughters. I think I would have developed more of an attachment because I would have seen not only the growth of the family, the growth of his career as an attorney, the growth of the love that the family had, but then also the tearing asunder of that relationship when the family gets to Auschwitz. And there were some difficult passages in the book. There was a chapter about the train ride after they were all told to leave Berlin, and they were in the train cars going to Auschwitz, not knowing where they were going. There was the because we're only seeing the story from the point of view of our main character, there's the questioning as to what happened to his wife and his two daughters. And so I kind of feel as if it had been told in a straight linear fashion, there would have been more of an emotional connection to all four of the characters, not just the attachment to the main character that we were supposed to have. But it did raise a very interesting question about kind of what how would we be in that type of a situation? How would we, if faced with a situation where we have to take a stance which we know is not going to engender us any pure benefit, it's not going to save our life. In this situation, he knew he was going to die. He's being asked to defend a guard, somebody whose main job is to eliminate himself and everybody else of his kind. Of that religion, would we do it? Would any of us do it? Would any of us want to take on the defense of somebody who we know is tasked with the job of killing us, where our success does not provide us with any tangible benefit? It's not going to save our lives, but failure certainly would hasten our demise. And I think that that was an area, as I talk about it now, that wasn't really explored very well. And I think it could have been. I think there could have been a little bit more of a discussion, maybe internal monologue of the main character as to the positives and negatives of taking on this defense. I mean, my own reaction would be, go to hell. You're on trial because you are alleged to have killed another Nazi officer. You get your own attorney. I'm not going to help you. Why should I? Your job is to kill me or make my life as miserable as possible. And nothing I do, whether I succeed or fail, is going to change what your job is with respect to my continued misery. And so I wonder, how any of us would fare in that same situation. And maybe that was the author's intent, or maybe that was one of the added bonuses of the story this way, is that it causes the reader to think, what would I do if I were in that situation? So I really liked it. I would have liked it to have been longer. I've said that about some books before. I would have liked it to have been longer. And I think I'm interested if I would have developed the emotional connection to the main character and his family if it had been told start to finish in a linear chronological fashion. I'm kind of curious because I didn't feel the emotional drain or the emotional release or just the emotions that I anticipated feeling because I didn't have the connection with the character. I definitely had the emotional reaction because this character was just one amongst 6 million who perished at the hands of the Nazis. And so there's just an inherent feeling of sadness and dismay for what happened during the Holocaust. But it wasn't simply because of the relationship that I had with these characters. And I've been, I've certainly read other books that take place in the concentration camps during the Holocaust, where there has been a connection drawn to the characters themselves. I know that I recall Exodus by Leon Uris. There were long passages regarding the Holocaust. I remember Mila 18 by Leon Uris. I remember various other books where it wasn't so much the system as it was the characters themselves and what they went through. And when they did, in fact, perish, or for whatever, however it happened, they survived, there was an emotional reaction to it, not just by virtue of the fact of the setting of the story. But that I really would recommend it. I think I gave it 4 stars. I thought it was a compelling idea for a story. I'm interested again if I would have had a similar or maybe a different emotional reaction if it had been told in a different way. But I really liked the idea of it, and so that's why I gave it the 4 stars. Now I needed after that something a little bit different. I needed kind of like a throwaway, and so I found this book at Sam's Club or where it was, called Alpha by Greg Rucka. And I hadn't read anything by him before. I had seen some stuff after I picked up this book. I looked up the guy online and I saw he's written, I think, comic books or graphic novels and other series of books. But this one was particularly interesting to me because it basically was Die Hard at an amusement park. That's pretty much what it was. And it made no bones about it. It's not just any amusement park. It's an amusement park that's made to be almost exactly like Disneyland. And in fact, there are references in the book to Disneyland being this particular amusement park's competitor. And it's called Wilsonville, and similar to Disneyland, it's named after an individual who created a character and created a universe of characters. And so the amusement park is based after these characters. And I thought that the author did a fantastic job of creating this world, creating this amusement park, basically, where even in the book, there's a diagram of it where all the rides are. And he created, it's just amazing creativity and imagination to create characters and create storylines for these characters, because this ride has to be with this storyline and this character interacts with that character. And there were songs and there were rides and attractions and shows, and it was just an amazingly detailed and creative idea that this guy had. And it just so happens that there's a belief that there's going to be a terrorist attack at this amusement park, and so as part of the preparation and security for it, the amusement park hires this ex-Delta Force operative named Jad Bell. And so Jad Bell becomes the chief of security, and just to make matters worse, his estranged ex-wife and their daughter and a group of other kids are coming to the park on a field trip, and it just so happens that it's that weekend, that day, that they're all there, that the terrorists actually do take their action against the park, and then obviously chaos ensues. So that's it. I mean, it's Die Hard at an amusement park. And I enjoyed it. It was, to me, it was kind of a throwaway. It wasn't particularly designed to be anything compelling, intellectual or thought-provoking. It really wasn't. It was just fun. As I gave it 4 stars, probably, I think I meant like 3.5, but 4 stars. And I think it was 4 stars as opposed to 3.5 just because of the creativity. But it was just a lot of fun. And I would be interested in more books with this character. I don't know if there's going to be more, but I thought that the character was a pretty creative and a likable character. Similar, I felt, to the Matthew Riley books involving Sean Schofield. I don't remember what his first name was. Schofield, Scarecrow, and his team of operatives, or his Delta Force, whoever they were. Very similar. They all have, you know, creative call signs, and they all know each other from, you know, 10, 15 years, and they're intimately aware of what everybody's thinking. And, you know, it turns out that as preparation for these anticipated terrorist attacks, the head of security prior to Jad Bell had also enlisted various of Bell's other teammates to be working at the park as well. So I liked it. I thought it was fun. Looking forward to more from him, because I think I'd be interested in reading more. I read a book after that called City of Women by David Gillham, G-I-L-L-H-A-M. And this was a recommendation from the same person who recommended, what was that book? Book Thief, who recommended The Book Thief to me. And this one takes place during the Holocaust, during World War II in Berlin. And it's basically, it's a woman whose husband is off fighting the war, and she doesn't know what to do with herself. Well, she does. I mean, she works every day at the patent office typing up patent applications or whatever it is. Nothing particularly impressive. But, you know, all the women are being told, everybody's working, that everything they do is a contribution to the war effort. And she ends up getting mixed up with this woman who is hiding Jews and trying to get them to safety. And so it's basically a chick lit book. I mean, that's what it was. There were no real strong men characters in the book. Our main character, Sigrid, falls in love with a guy who, it turns out, is a Jew, and she ends up having to help hide him. And I found that it had, it kind of stuttered at parts. It was fast and very readable at some parts, and then other parts it slowed down dramatically, and then it would speed up, and then it would slow down. Not my typical book. Certainly the genre, the World War II Germany is topics that I am interested in. But I don't know. You can call me misogynist, you can call me sexist. I just don't, chauvinistic, whatever it is. I just don't relate well to female characters. And all the male characters were weak, or they were not to be trusted, or they weren't particularly likable. And so I didn't really have a strong connection to the main character. She did make a fairly dramatic change from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, which I thought was an interesting character arc. But I didn't really feel a whole lot of compassion for her. I thought that she changed very, even though it was the character arc did change, it was 180 degrees, it seemed like it happened pretty quickly. And not only that, one of the things about it that really kind of drove me a little bit crazy was that in a time in which I was always led to believe that, and there are parts of the book where it reinforces this, that you really can't trust anybody. I mean, there were rumors that your neighbor was going to be ratting you out. And we saw that. There was an instance in which they were all in a bomb shelter. Everybody in the apartment building were in a bomb shelter because there was an air raid going on. And one of the people in the bomb shelter stands up and starts saying something bad about Hitler. And then the next day you find out that she's dead, and, you know, they're cleaning out her apartment. And so you're led to believe that somebody in the bomb shelter had ratted her out and the Nazis came for her and took her away or whatever it was. And so it reinforces that belief that you can't trust anybody, that you weren't allowed to trust anybody, that you had to really mind your P's and Q's or else somebody would say something about you and the next thing you know, you'd be gone and never heard from again. And yet, as Sigrid starts to entertain the idea of becoming this harborer of Jews and helping to hide them and get them papers to emigrate out, she tells a lot of people this, and she takes a lot of people into her confidences, and it's kind of amazing to me how easily she felt it was okay to divulge these things. So it was, yeah, interesting that there were people who were very clearly drawn as being untrustworthy, and yet there were other people who she felt she could go to, which was kind of amusing. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. I kept waiting for her to tell somebody and have it backfire and find out that these people were ratting her out. And I mean, she did have an interaction with an SS officer, and the interaction went, I guess, well enough, because she didn't end up getting killed or anything like that or taken away. But she really didn't have a lot of drama in that respect, and she seemed to be pretty safe divulging this stuff to kind of to whoever she decided to. I'm reading my own review on Goodreads. I gave it 4 stars. Probably would have given it 3.5, just because of the reasons I kind of already illuminated. If this guy writes more books, I'd be interested. I don't think he's written any other books. I think this is his first, actually. So I'd be interested to see what other ideas he comes up with, whether he does, maybe write a similar, not a similar book, but a book in the same, same time period, same location, but maybe from a man, involving a man. I don't know. But what can I tell you? I've mentioned it before. I'm not really big on women characters and women authors. I'm really sorry. Hey, that's the way I am. The last book I read, was Roosevelt's Beast by Louis Bayard. And I've mentioned Louis before. And I can call him Louis because he's a Facebook friend of mine, for whatever that's worth. It's interesting. So Louis has written 4 or 5 books, I think. A couple of them, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is his 7th book. And I've read 5 of them. The first 2 I have not read. I don't know anything about them. I don't even think they're available. I haven't been able to find them anywhere. But these 5 books that I've read all seem to be of similar genre. They're historical fiction where they take real life characters or real life fictional characters, and one book in particular does that. And it crafts a mystery around them. The first book that I read of his was Mr. Timothy, and it basically took the character of Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol, brings him up to a little bit of an older age, so he's more of a, I think, teenager adult, and then puts him into society at the time that he would have been that age, and there's some mystery, and it, involves the seedier side of Victorian England. And it was really interesting. I think it was one of the first Victorian thrillers, mysteries that I read. The second book I read was The Pale Blue Eye, which took took Edgar Allan Poe while he was a cadet at West Point, and there's a murder, and Edgar Allan Poe is one of the people who seeks to solve the mystery. The other 2 books, The Black Tower, The School of Night, similar, take real life people from history and puts them into dramatic and mysterious events. So this book, Roosevelt's Beast, takes place during the Roosevelt-Rondon expedition to South America, which was in the mid-1910s. I think it was like 1913, 1914. And a lot has been written about this time period. It's Teddy Roosevelt's voyage through the River of Doubt, and I know there's been a lot of nonfiction written about this. But apparently, my understanding is that there is a period of time a few days at least, I believe, where Roosevelt and his son Kermit Roosevelt, who was on the expedition with him, go missing, and their whereabouts during this period of time is unaccounted for and was never discovered. And so what Lewis does is he creates this event that takes place, which gives an explanation as to where Kermit and Teddy Roosevelt were during this period of time that they were away from the rest of the expeditionary crew. And it's really fascinating. It's not typical for me to read books that take place in the jungle. Frankly, it seems like it's a slows down the pace a little bit. I can't really visualize the jungle very well. It's not my typical. But because it was written by Lewis and I've enjoyed all of his other books, that's why I picked it up and I got it the day it came out and got a chance to read it over a few days. And I really liked it. It reminded me of a Lincoln Child Douglas Preston book with the character of Pendergast. And I don't know if any of you have read the Aloysius Pendergast novels before. The first one that I read of his was called The Cabinet of Curiosities, and there's been plenty of others since then. Still Life with Crows, Brimstone, Dance of Death, on and on and on. There have been, I don't know, 8 or 9 books. And Pendergast always seems to be involved in a mystery that has some sort of a supernatural connection. And some of them, Pendergast, solves the mystery and is able to uncover the truth and find out that the truth is nothing particularly supernatural at all. And in others, like I think Cabinet of Curiosities, there is a supernatural element that remains a supernatural element, that there is just some sort of a phenomenon that Pendergast is not able to explain to a rational thinking person such as myself. It's just, it's supernatural. That's what it is. And so there was an element of that in this book, because the concept is that the two Roosevelts, Teddy and Kermit, are captured by this this tribe of people, that lives in the jungles, and they are apparently being terrorized by this beast that is killing various members of the tribe, but killing them in a particularly horrifying way, and does not seem to be leaving any traces of the beast's existence when it leaves. However, it leaves. There's no footprints, there's no trails, there's no blood everywhere. It's a pretty neat little crime scene. And the villagers think that this beast can be sought out and killed by the two Roosevelts. And so that's their job, is to hunt and kill this beast so that they can gain their freedom to get back to their own, to get back to their group of expeditioners. And so there's a supernatural element to it, because as Kermit and Teddy examine the crime scenes of where the bodies, as where the people were killed, there's no obvious clues as to what type of an animal this beast is. There's no footprints, there's no tracks, there's no nothing. The explanation is at one point given that it's got to be something that could fly, but if it can fly or can jump into the trees and travel by trees, why, how could it be a beast that large to kill these other, not only humans, but also killing some other large animals and beasts of its own? And so there's that supernatural element to it. It does end up taking a little bit of a turn to a place that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting it to follow a Pendergast novel and perhaps provide just a supernatural type of an element to it. But to the point where there actually was a creature, I don't want to give anything away about the resolution of the mystery of the beast, but it felt a little bit like the book that I had read and we talked about a few months ago with the Jack the Ripper Thames Torso Murders, that the book Mayhem by Sarah Pinbrough, that it was sort of like this beast that attaches to a person where the person becomes the beast. And so it was a little bit unexpected. I'm not going to say it was bad. It was just a little unexpected. There were some interesting literary tricks that Lewis put in to create this kind of fugue state that Kermit goes through, having these weird discussions with dead relatives and having these visions and things like that. So it did give it a bit of a creepy, supernatural type of a feel to it. But all in all, it was a good entry from Lewis. I really liked it. The one comment I have about Lewis is it just takes so long to get books out, because it seems like it's been a few years since the last book, which was called The School of Night, had come out. And actually, I can tell you when The School of Night came out, because I remember distinctly that it was 2012 in the summer that my wife and I and our youngest daughter visited Washington, D.C., and I distinctly remember going to the Library of Congress, and through the Library of Congress, we ended up at the Library of Congress's bookstore, or gift shop, whatever it was, and right there on the stacks, right as you walk in the door, in prominent display, was Lewis's most recent book, The School of Night, and it's in hardcover, so I remember at that point, I remember the book had just come out, and I'd actually had read it not too long before we went on the vacation to Washington. And as I mentioned, Lewis is a Facebook friend of mine, which means I see his posts and I like things. And in fact, I think I posted something on Facebook or whatever about having finally ordered the book, this one, that Roosevelt's Beast, and was excited for it. And he, whatever it was, retweeted it or whatever, you know, social media thing you do at that point. But so I remember as I saw the book at the Library of Congress, I videotaped having seen it in the Library of Congress, and I sent it to him, and I think he gave a response back that he had a friend of his who stocked the books, and that's how it got there, something kind of self-deprecating like that. But he seems like he's a good guy. He's got great ideas. The stories that he comes up with are great. I'm actually kind of intrigued with the idea of taking historical events where there are no explanations for the events, and having the author create an explanation, right or wrong. That was what I'd hoped from the book that we talked about before, Mystery of the Ghost of the Mary Celeste by Valerie Martin, which was this ghost ship that we talked about. I kind of hoped that book would be a little bit more along the lines of the way Lewis would write it, which is to give an explanation. It doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be true. It's just an explanation. It's one author's concept, taking this historical confusing event or this historical question mark and putting an answer to it, right or wrong, just because it's entertaining. And it involves characters that we know or people that we know or events that we're familiar with. And so that's something that one of the things I'd want to ask is, where do you come up with this idea? You know, maybe on Facebook, and Lewis, how did you come up with this idea? Where did you come up with the knowledge that there was this period of time during the expedition where Teddy and Kermit were unaccounted for? And how did you learn this? And where do you come up with these ideas? Because I think it would be fascinating, because there's no rules. You know, I had mentioned it in previous podcasts. There are no rules. You can do whatever you like. I think I mentioned it with respect to the book about, was it Mary Shelley? I didn't talk about that one. It was the other one. The Lynn Shepherd book that involved the characters from Bleak House and the woman in white, where there's no rules. You can do whatever you want. You can call it whatever you want. You can create anything you want. But you have the built-in connection to the characters because you already know these people. You know them through history. You know them through your previous literary adventure. So it's kind of an interesting idea where you have it. One of the things I think an author struggles with, or a challenge that every author would face, is creating a character from scratch that your reader can either identify with or can make a connection with. And it's difficult because if you want the reader to feel an emotion towards that character, you've got to create the character so that it derives this type of emotion. But if you find a historical figure, or you find a classical literary character, you don't have to work as hard to create that connection for the reader, because the reader already has it. Good or bad, the reader already knows who this person is. And so if I were to write a book about, you know, George Washington, everybody knows who George Washington is. I don't need to create him in a way that will give him a character. I don't need to create him in a way that will give him a look or an identity, because it's already built in. We already know who he is. good or bad. Now, I could write a book about George Washington. I could say he was a liar and a cheat and a thief, even though we know he was the George Washington who could never tell a lie. But your reader already has that built-in connection and knowledge of the character that it rescues the writer in some respect from having to create that. And I think it allows the writer more of an opportunity to really focus on the drama of the story, whether it's the mystery or it's the complex events that are being portrayed in the book. So it's interesting. Having read quite a few of these books by Lewis Bayard, Matthew Pearl, other writers that take historical or classic literary figures and put them into new situations or create drama around them, I think that would be an interesting endeavor, something that I'd be interested in if I were going to write a book, maybe undertaking. And that kind of leads me to the book I'm reading now, which I'm really excited about. I'm really, really excited about this book. It's called The Revenant at Thraxton Hall. And it's by, let me see, Vaughn Entwistle, The Revenant of Thraxton Hall. Here you go. It's got a subtitle. The Revenant of Thraxton Hall, The Paranormal Casebooks of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And Arthur Conan Doyle was actually the main character, as we talked in The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. And Arthur Conan Doyle had this fascination with mediums and seances and psychic abilities. And so this book, and I think it's the first book by Vaughn Entwistle, it places Conan Doyle in same time period as he lived. So it's actually the same time period. And it starts with him having written the story that resulted in Sherlock Holmes' death, the final problem, I think is what it was called. And so he's already the most hated man in London or in England or perhaps even the world because he's killed off this national hero. And he gets summoned to this woman's house. And under mysterious circumstances, she explains to him that she is a psychic and that she has foreseen that in 2 weeks' time she's going to be murdered. And so she asks, and she says it's going to take place at a seance that she's conducting. And all the faces around the table are blurry except for the person sitting directly to her left, which is Arthur Conan Doyle. And so it's an interesting premise. She now wants Arthur to solve her mystery of her murder before it even takes place. And Conan Doyle is a little bit suspicious of this. He thinks it's a joke. He doesn't think it's true. But he investigates a little further and decides he's going to play along and he's going to go ahead and investigate. And along the way, he picks up his good friend, Oscar Wilde, yet another famous literary figure. And the two of them go to Thraxton Hall, this estate on the outskirts of London, in the countryside of London, to solve this murder. So I'm about maybe 25% of the way through. I'm really enjoying it so far, and I'm looking forward to finishing this one up, because I think it's got some good possibilities. So that's what I've been reading so far. Other than that, I don't know. I've got some other stuff on my bookshelf I'm looking into and looking forward to. And like I said, next time we're going to talk about The Trident Deception by Rick Campbell. And we're also going to do a little bit of a history of Phil's and my reading of the techno thriller. So we'll probably take a nice little walk down memory lane of our childhood or our teenage years, wanting to be naval pilots and submarine captains and things like that. So anyways, that's about it for this time. I wanted to catch you up on what's been going on with me. Please find me at BookTherapy13 or as my Twitter, or RobCohen13.com as my blog page. Send me an email at BookTherapy13@gmail.com. And this is Rob Cohen. Thank you for letting me lie on your couch.